Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI says holidays are not about leaving for the sake of leaving and resting, but rather about living our relationship with our loved ones in a new way with God. The bishops of Southern Africa raise the alarm and shine the light on the plight of the people of Swaziland. And we hear the story of an ancient wooden plaque taken by a soldier from the Abbey of Monte Cassino in 1944, and this year returned to where it came from by the Dean of Westminster Abbey. Pope Benedict XVI has urged those preparing to go on holiday to make space for the gospel. The Pope's words came when greeting those gathered in St. Peter's Square on Sunday to pray the midday Angelus. Speaking in French, the Pope offered a brief reflection on summer holidays. Charles Collins has this report.
Just a few days before leaving the Vatican for the papal summer residence in Castel Gandolfo, Pope Benedict XVI reflected on the rest offered by Jesus Christ. Speaking from his window overlooking St. Peter's Square during his Sunday Angelus, the Pope said, just as in the time of the Gospel, many people in the poorest countries are burdened by poverty. And even in the richest countries, people face dissatisfaction and depression. He then spoke of those people who are displaced or refugees, leaving the homelands even at the risk of their own lives. He said, Jesus says to all of them, come unto me.
Into this gospel, Jesus invites all of us to come to him, whatever burdens we may be carrying, whatever labors we may be engaged in, because in him we will find rest.
But the Pope says there is a condition to take on the yoke of Christ, which is the law of love. The Holy Father said the true remedy for the wounds of humanity, be they material, such as hunger and injustice, or psychological and moral, caused by a false well-being, is a rule of life based on brotherly love, which has its source in God. Pope Benedict then offered some words to those who will be vacationing this summer.
It's this time of year when so many of you are taking your annual holiday, I pray that you will truly find refreshment for body and spirit and an opportunity to rest in the Lord. May God bestow his blessings of joy and peace upon all of you and upon your families and loved ones at home.
The Holy Father leaves for Castel Gandolfo on Wednesday and will deliver next week's Angelus address from the courtyard of the papal summer residence.
Thanks there to Charles Collins for that report. And staying here in the Vatican, 60 well-known artists have donated works for the exhibition The Splendor of Truth, The Beauty of Charity, opening on Monday in the atrium of the Paul VI Hall. The works on show include paintings, sculptures, music and architecture. And at the inauguration of the exhibition, Pope Benedict launched an appeal to artists all over the world. Chris Altieri tells us more.
Scores of the world's best artists in fields of endeavor ranging from painting to sculpture to music to architecture donated works, mostly originals, for the exhibition The Splendor of Truth, The Beauty of Charity.
E proprio dall'unione, vorrei dire, dalla sinfonia, dalla perfetta armonia di verità e carità, che emana l'autentica bellezza.
In remarks to the contributors and organizers on Monday at the inauguration of the exhibition in the atrium of the Paul VI Audience Hall here at the Vatican, Pope Benedict XVI launched what he called a friendly and a heartfelt appeal to artists everywhere.
Non scendete mai la creatività artistica dalla verità e dalla carità.
Never separate truth and charity from your artistic creativity, he prayed. Never seek beauty far from truth and charity, but rather with the richness of your genius, of your creative impulse, be ever and with courage seekers of truth and witnesses of charity. Make the truth shine forth in your works, and make sure that their beauty will inspire in the eyes and hearts of those who admire them the desire and the need to make existence beautiful and true. All existence, enriching it by that treasure which is inexhaustible, which makes life a masterpiece and every man an extraordinary artist. Charity. Love. The exhibition is being hosted in the Paul VI Hall here at the Vatican from July 4th to September 4th. I'm Chris Altieri.
Thanks to Chris Altieri for that report. And the Catholic bishops of Southern Africa have raised their concern regarding news of a request by the government of the Kingdom of Swaziland for a financial bailout by the South African Treasury. It is understood that an amount of 10 billion rand is needed to keep the Swazi government afloat and the administration from collapsing. It's an occasion, I thought, to shine the light on a small nation which really is out of range of interest and knowledge for most people. First of all, geographically. Officially the Kingdom of Swaziland, it's a tiny landlocked country in southern Africa, bordered to the north, south and west by South Africa, and to the east by Mozambique. The nation, as well as its people, are named after the 19th century king, Mswati II. Beautiful it may certainly be with its Lebombo Mountains and nature reserves, but the SACBC bishops point out that Swaziland is currently in the throes of an unprecedented financial and social crisis. It has the highest HIV and AIDS infection rate in the world, at 26%. The lowest life expectancy in the world, only 32 years. An unemployment rate of 40% and rising, and extreme poverty with 70% of its population living below the poverty line of less than $6 a day. The people also live in a state of emergency that has curtailed freedom of expression, association and dissent for the last 37 years. The bishops express their belief that the Swaziland government must abandon or at least reform the Tinkhundla system of governance, that is, of royal favour and alliance, which they say is a breeding place for corruption and greed. South Africa, meanwhile, has denied it has approved King Mswati III's request for a bailout loan. He had already reportedly turned to the IMF, which said he must do more to slim down Africa's most bloated bureaucracy if he wanted any aid to stay afloat. I spoke to exiled Swazi opposition activist Mfana Futhi Tsena about the situation in his homeland. Many questions came to mind, but first of all, I wanted to know why, with such a dramatic human rights record, the plight of the Swazi people is hardly ever in the international news.
I don't know why Swaziland has never been the bigger issue, but what I can say is that Swaziland have been under a state of emergency for about 38 years now, where political activity have been banned. And it's just those unfortunate things where, like, sometimes the international community would like maybe some specific countries, maybe for other reasons which I cannot say it's what. But that is why maybe Swaziland has never been like in the news. But the human rights situation in Swaziland is very bad, in such a way that, like, even political activity is banned. Political parties, to belong to a political party, it's criminal. So some things which you, even in countries like Zimbabwe, which have always been like in the limelight of the international media, it's like those basic rights, like freedom of to belong to a political party, is like something which Swazis take as a luxury.
Yes, I wish Zimbabwe was more in the limelight as well. But anyway,
yes. What
happened 38 years ago?
What happened is that the present king's father, the late king, repealed that constitution and declared a state of emergency and ruled by decree. That is when, like, maybe Swazis lost all of their rights. Like, there was a lot of political persecution from opponents of the king's rule. Yeah, a lot of detentions and people forced into exile.
Have things changed in Swaziland since the South African regime has changed?
It did change because Swaziland, like some other people would say, it was a de facto Bantustan. Even though it was said to be independent, but it was not independent. It was still dependent on South Africa in one way or another. And when South Africa changed to a democratic dispensation, like, there was a lot of expectations from Swazis that maybe even Swaziland would change, because even the other neighbor, Mozambique, also changed and become a multi-party democratic state. But Swaziland has remained as an undemocratic state. And the unfortunate thing is that even these countries which are bordering Swaziland have not been helping that much as far as democratization of the country. Even the regional organizations like SADC, they've turned a blind eye on Swaziland. That is one of the unfortunate things.
You are an activist, but you are living in exile. What kind of activities are you able to bring forward?
I think one of the things which we do, and which I think we have been very successful in, is like the international mobilization for the isolation of the Swazi regime. Like in South Africa, for instance, we have been able to push the Swazi question to be in the agenda. Like something which was not there before. People were just like taking Swaziland as like something. But those of us who are outside the country have been able to mobilize the world, the international world, like to know what is happening in Swaziland. And I think we have been successful in that front. Yeah.
What is your opinion regarding the request to South Africa to give Swaziland a 10 billion rand loan?
We are opposed. We are totally opposed to the bailing out of Swaziland, because Swaziland is in this situation it's not by accident. It's not like even some of the reasons which they are using like that is because of the global economic crisis and the reduction in the SACU or the South African Customs Union revenue. I think those are not the real reasons why Swaziland is in this situation. The main reason is the mismanagement and the blunder by the ruling elite. So we are opposed. We are totally opposed to any bailout by the South African government and any reason to discuss the economic crisis in Swaziland would have to involve the civil organizations like the trade unions and the opposition parties in Swaziland. So if the South African government want to give the Swazi government some bailout, with ourselves, we will say they're just like trying to sustain the system, the undemocratic system. It's not going to help Swazis in any way.
It doesn't sound as though it's in the interests of South Africa either, though.
It's not in the interest of South Africa, because if ever they can give Swaziland that money, there's no guarantee, whether it's a loan or if it's a loan, it's even unfortunate. There's no guarantee that that money will be used in a prudent way. So there is no guarantee that that money will go to what it's supposed to be going to. And once Swaziland is a democratic government, I think South Africa should not expect the democratic government to pay that money back.
I was on the internet today and I was having a look at some news that was coming out of Swaziland, and some of it was very, very, very shocking. I read, for example, that one of the ministers have just recently proposed that HIV-infected people be branded as a way to curb, he says, the infection. Do you have any knowledge of this?
No, I'm not aware of that, but I would not be surprised, because what I know is that, like, even the fact, it's not by accident that Swaziland has got the highest infection in the world. It's because of the type of government we have, you know. Like, the king, for instance, is a very bad example. He's got many wives. He's somebody who just, like, take wives, and is a bad example. So it's some of the reasons which have been happening. In fact, not long ago, there was also another member of parliament who was also calling for the brand, that people who are HIV should be branded. So I would not be surprised.
I have noticed that there have been some protests in Swaziland. Do the protesters risk anything by going into the streets and demonstrating?
Definitely they do. They do, because like most of the time, when there are protests, the protests are crushed. In fact, like last year on May Day, one of the members of the People's United Democratic Movement was arrested for wearing a T-shirt of the opposition party, and he was killed inside prison. So like, it's very risky for people to protest, but that doesn't mean that they don't protest. Even on the 12th of April, there were some protests against the regime, and a lot of people were detained, they were assaulted, there was a violent crackdown on protest action, yeah.
I understand that recently there have been big festivities, both to celebrate the birthday of the king and to celebrate, I think, 40 years of independence. Amongst the guests was Robert Mugabe. Is he an ally, a friend of the king?
Yes, there was a birthday, which was, in fact, the 40th anniversary of the independence plus the king's birthday, which was like there was a lot of money which was spent to celebrate that. And it was very unfortunate because Swazis don't benefit. You know, Swaziland is one of the most unequal societies in the world. That is one of the unfortunate things when you spend this lavish lifestyle of the king. And it's true that Robert Mugabe was there and other presidents from other countries in Africa.
I don't know if you know, but the bishops, the Catholic bishops of Southern Africa, have issued a very strong statement regarding the situation in Swaziland. And they are asking the Swaziland government to abandon the Tinkundla system of governance, of royal favour. They're also shining the light on the abuse and the inequality the people of Swaziland live with.
Yes, in fact, and it's not just the Catholic, even the Anglican bishops are also like have also joined the campaign for democratic dispensation in Swaziland.
Are you hopeful that this spurt of news that's getting Swaziland finally into the limelight? Are you hopeful it's going to have an effect?
Definitely. Swaziland will eventually democratize. It's just a question of when. But the momentum has already started, and it's obvious that in the near future, Swaziland will be a democratic state.
Is there anything else you would like to say?
There's not much other than to say, like, sometimes we are a little bit disappointed with the blind eye which the international community turn on Swaziland. Sometimes we feel like they're double standards. They talk about democracy in other countries, and in other countries, they don't see it as essential. So those are the things which we feel like we are a little bit disappointed. But that doesn't mean that that is going to stop our struggle. At the same time, we are also grateful to the international solidarity that we are getting from people from other countries, like in South Africa and in other countries all over the world.
And turning to something quite different, a few weeks before leaving Rome for his annual summer travels to pursue his work for Interreligious Dialogue, my friend, Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright, regaled me with an interesting story. It's about an ancient wooden panel taken by a soldier from the Abbey of Monte Cassino in 1944, and this year returned to where it came from by the Dean of Westminster Abbey in London.
As a Benedictine monk, of course, I follow matters Benedictine quite closely and as far as possible from Rome. And carrying this title of the titular abbot of Westminster Abbey in London, of course, gives me a nice alternative ancient Benedictine community, now, of course, an Anglican church and centre of so many wonderful things in the liturgies and ceremonies of Britain and the United Kingdom. Monte Cassino, the place which Haya persuaded Benedict from his cave in Subiaco to be their superior, and was where he wrote the rule around about 500 AD, or compiled the rule more accurately, was also badly destroyed, as many of you will know, in 1944 by the Allies during their advance through Italy. It being a very strategic place with a very good view over the surrounding countryside. So in that destruction, it was agreed that the Americans actually bombed it would repay by rebuilding it. And that is the Morte Cassino we have today, the massive, wonderful monastery on the top of that hill overlooking the plains below, right over to the sea. Over a number of occasions in recent years, the abbot, the archabbot of Monte Cassino, has undertaken an initiative to have a sort of pilgrimage of peace, to recall the destruction of Monte Cassino, to put aside any sense of guilt and grievance arising from it, and more positively, a determination to heal wounds and to promote peace, not just in Europe, but throughout the world. And one of the ways he does this is by organizing a group from Cassino, the town of Cassino, and some of the monks, to visit another city, obviously mainly in Europe, where they will go to the cathedral or to the monastery, and they'll have a candle lit, a little ceremony, and then that candle is solemnly brought back to Monte Cassino around about the time of the Feast of St. Benedict on the 21st of March. This year, the chosen place to visit was Westminster Abbey in London. And I was privileged, of course, as the titular abbot, to be invited to take part by the Dean, Dean John Hall, and one or two of the canons who were present there, Jane Hedges, wonderful woman canon, the first woman canon of Westminster Abbey, ordained priest in the Anglican Church. And she was there, and various other of the junior canons as well, as well as the choir. And we had a evensong with bishops from the Anglican Church and bishops from Italy, particularly the Bishop of Norcia, and, as I say, several monks and people from Cassino, and a congregation of perhaps 300 or 400 people in the abbey to celebrate this prayer for peace within the context of their evening liturgy, evensong. And it was a wonderful moment at the end when the dean with the abbot, they lit the candle and a procession out to take the candle eventually back to Monte Cassino. And that was the start of a little pilgrimage. Probably about 2 weeks later, we arrive at the 20th of March and I'm invited down to Monte Cassino itself, to the abbey, to see the reception of the lighted candle and to continue the prayer for peace throughout the world. And in those ceremonies, we had a Vespers on the evening of the 20th of March, to which Canon John Hall was present with one of his junior canons and myself, and various other local guests, and they provided a wonderful little ceremony of Vespers and special prayer, special readings, homilies, to mark the occasion, followed by a nice concert in the abbey, then a festive meal, and then a mass the following morning to celebrate the big feast of St. Benedict. Now, during the course of all that, there was one little story which moved many of us there almost to tears. The story goes like this, that Canon John Hall brought to Monte Cassino, covered in bright red cloth, a plaque, a wooden plaque, with an engraving of the Nativity. And the story is that after the Battle of Monte Cassino, one of the Allied soldiers, who was presumably walking around the ruins of the abbey, found this plaque lying down and picked it up. Clearly, it was obviously just a bit of wood lying on the ground. There was nothing to... It wasn't painted. It was just probably oak, about half a metre long and a few centimetres wide and fairly thin. So it was quite easy to carry. So he took it off and thought that would be a nice souvenir for him. Story is, I think, that he later got injured. And the nurse, who was not a Catholic, cared for him, and as a sign of his thanks, he gave her the plaque. So the plaque went back to England, and time passed from 1944, and during that time this nurse had looked after numerous different people at different stages of their lives, etc., etc. And at one stage, one of the people who was looked after by her was the former British ambassador to the Holy See, Francis Campbell. When she came to die, or was dying, and wanted to dispose of her effects, she thought, well, who can I give this to? And obviously, Francis had touched her in some way, and they'd been friends. And so she passed from her Protestant position, Anglican Protestant position possibly, to the Catholic Francis Campbell, the plaque, which was part of the previous monastery at Monte Cassino. So with that, later on, he comes to hear of this initiative by the abbot of Archabbot of Monte Cassino to light his candle in Westminster Abbey. And so, thinking that this might be a nice gesture, he passes from the Catholic former ambassador to the Holy See, British ambassador to the Holy See, to the Anglican dean of Westminster Abbey, this plaque, saying that since Westminster Abbey is part of the Pilgrimage of Peace linked to Monte Cassino this year, why not offer this back as a gift? And so, at the end of one of the ceremonies in Monte Cassino, Dean John Hall, with this brilliantly red cover, presented this to the Archabbot, this plaque from the old Monte Cassino. So, in a lovely sort of way, everything had come full circle. The prayer for peace had brought always the intentions of where there is fighting and war going on. And behind the prayer for peace are the small little undergrowths of new life, of reconciliation, of return and rediscovery. And within that context, the plaque, the return of the plaque to the abbey at Monte Cassino was something that touched a lot of people, coming as it did from Britain, who were involved in the fighting at the Battle of Monte Cassino itself. And significantly enough, one of the monks in my own community at Ampleforth, Father George Forbes, he was a chaplain to some of the British forces there in Monte Cassino, and for his courageous prayer to encourage the soldiers was awarded the Military Cross, which is a decoration for bravery. And it's a nice way that these little threads link in with each other, and that our lives are never just one thing, but there are always other stories behind, and these other stories reveal to us that human interests and human feelings and human suffering and human pain and human joy are all interlinked in some way in our lives. And an event like the Pilgrimage of Peace and the restoration of this panel to its original owner just enriches the experience, and a wonderful experience it was too.
That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.